This is BPN Radio, your 24-hour internet prayer station, calling America to pray. It's time now for the Christian War Room with your host, Michael Schonborn. Now, here's Michael.
Welcome to the Christian War Room, and welcome to our talk here today. And we are in our series, and in a minute you'll pick up on it. This is the first time you've tuned in and you haven't heard any of the other War Room talks. Don't worry about it. You can do this at christianwarroom.com. And we had an introduction of this talk before. Actually, two introductions. And so I checked out the talks. It's 154 and 155, christianwarroom.com. So you can listen to the introduction as well, in case you've missed it. I'm not sure how interesting it is. It just looks at the whole theory of evolution. That's what we are talking about today. 100 ways to kill the theory of evolution. And today we're going to be looking at the first way. Way number one, method number one to try and kill it. And that's what we're going to do. Okay, let's have a look. I don't know whether you've seen this, depending where you live, whether you live in America or you live in Britain. Here in England, it seemed to be quite popular at one stage. I haven't seen them that much recently. I think the novelty has worn off. But what we find is there's sort of an increasing amount of animosity towards Christians. So a few years ago, they were just belittled of being a little bit weak-headed and needing a crutch to go through life, and this crutch is their religion. And so they were sort of a little bit belittled. And that has, I think, increasingly turned into some sort of rage, irrational rage, where a lot of people get actually quite upset when they have to deal with Christians. And obviously, God is responsible for everything bad, but for nothing good to be thanked for by these people. And what you find is that a lot of Christians, in the olden days, you saw a lot of, follow Jesus and so on, big stickers on the car. And that sort of went away, and you got like little fish. The fish stands for Ichthus. I think it's Jesus Christus, Horus, something else, meaning Jesus Christ, Lord and God, and Savior. Yeah, so it's like an acronym in Greek for what Jesus stands for, and what he is, and that word Ichthus means fish. Yeah. So it's got nothing to do with Peter catching fish in the Lake of Galilee or anything like that. It's just an interesting acronym. Yeah. And so Christians have been using this for many, many years, and especially evangelical Christians, to differentiate themselves from traditional or nominal Christians. Okay, so people latch onto this, and it was like a bit of a secret sign. If you saw a fish, you knew, this is most likely another Christian. And that sign became known. So people came up with another sign where they used a fish, and they put some legs on the fish, four legs, and sometimes inside they wrote Darwin. Yeah. And they pretty much tell them, look, I don't believe in God, I'm an atheist, I'm a Darwinist, I believe in the theory of evolution. Again, today what I want to look at is who are these guys who came up with the theory of evolution, and what authority do they really have? Can we trust them? Yeah. Or just from a logical aspect, can we trust of what these guys were saying? Or was it just like a bunch of fantasy? And one of the things people today don't understand is they don't understand the age and the time these guys have been living in when they started formulating these ideas based on flimsy evidence, to say the least. I mean, they didn't really have any evidence whatsoever. It was just an idea. And they tried to sell it off as science, and some of the guys were pushing really strongly to have this idea being pushed in schools. And that's really where the whole thing started, that kids grow up, and by the time they're grown up, they've taken this on board, they've lapped it up, and they are believing a lie and considering a lie to be a fact, and not really having any critical understanding of where do these ideas come from, how have these ideas been formed, how did they enter the scientific community, and how is it that today, if you are a scientist who doesn't subscribe to these laws or to this paradigm, that you are pretty much kicked out and your whole career is at stake. And so it's one way to silence you from the truth, by killing any objectivity or any real research, because You can only say, and you're only allowed to say, what fits within a certain paradigm. Go outside this paradigm at your own peril, and your career is finished. And bearing in mind that scientists don't earn that much money, it's a bit of a problem. Okay, let's have a look at a couple of names. I'm going to throw a couple of names to you, and I spent a bit of time just researching them. Having tools, these guys didn't have. Okay, these guys, all they had was just a couple of books, ideas. They were reading an awful lot more, and good on them. But anyway, they didn't have a lot of information available to them we have today. So one of them is called Charles Darwin, and I'm sure you know him. We're going to look at his life for a minute. We've got a guy called Herbert Spencer, who is less known, and also a contemporary of Charles Darwin, which is Thomas Henry Huxley. We probably know, or you would have heard of his son called Aldous Huxley, so he's written a lot of books. They're all sort of from the gentry, from industrialists, and then we've got Ernst Haeckel in Germany. So he was like a big guy who has done this. And then we've got a guy called Charlie Lyell, also a contemporary of Charles Darwin. And he sort of was a geologist, and he was sort of moving the whole idea about the stratas representing times and things like that. But again, they were just ideas which would all come together, and they tried to make it all fit somehow. There was no real evidence other than that. Later, we find that, what these ideas they came up with and they formulated, they were just taken into, the pantheon of science, and they were taken as fact. And then we've got a big problem. We're going to see this later as well, and that's just the way sort of it came around. We've got a guy called Russell Wallace, and he was contemporary with Charles Darwin, and he had pretty much the same ideas. And again, we find that suddenly there was a bit of a contest going on between the two of them. And then we've got a guy called Jean-Baptiste Lamarck, and he had this concept of evolution well before Charles Darwin. It was never, I'm not sure, I think he was a French guy. The French are probably pushing him more than Charles Darwin. And these are sort of some key names. We're going to look at them in this talk here. Okay, let's have a look at Charles Darwin. And we have to see it at a couple of aspects as well. What was driving them? Why did they come up with this paradigm? We need to look at, their religious views, their political views. Then we need to look as well, at the timeline, what time were they living in, what knowledge was available to them. It's very, very important, because today, having the internet and having access to tons and tons of knowledge at a keystroke, you can inform yourself really, really fast, and you can zoom into one area very, very fast, especially having access to papers worldwide. We also need to look at the timeline, the zeitgeist, what was going on in this time, What do we see? What was sort of the stuff people were getting into? And then we need to look as well at some aspects, of terminology which was phrased. So we had, for example, in the timeline where Charles Darwin was active, in the Victorian age, we got the term dinosaur phrased. And then very often people say, oh, they're not dinosaurs in the Bible, but I can see evidence of them all over. And thing is, in the olden days, there was a different term used for dinosaur, which was dragon. And dragons, or evidence of dragons, is still there today. There's still people who can describe to you dragons and who say they've seen them. But again, nobody takes them serious, and because it doesn't fit into the whole concept of the theory of evolution into modern science. Okay, about Charles Darwin. Charles Darwin was born in 1809 and he died in 1882. So the century he covered was the 1800s, and that was the Victorian age. He was born in Shrewsbury. He did travel a lot. His mother died when he was 8 years old. His father was a doctor, so he was fairly reasonably wealthy. He was looking after the wealthy as well. Charles Darwin got buried in the Abbey of Westminster, which is quite bizarre as well. Why this guy should be buried inside a church, I think even at his own bequest, he might have preferred not to be there. And it goes even further. It goes really, really bizarre. He was really into experiments and stuff like that, and he wasn't very good at school, so his dad took him out of school and he put him to Edinburgh to study medicine at university. He did this for 2 years, but wasn't very successful. And he was really interested sort of in nature and biology, which is a good thing. And his father then decided, okay, let's, turn him into a clergyman. And he went to the University of Cambridge and he studied there. And he actually graduated as well as a clergyman. So he did theology, graduated as a clergyman. And then in 1831, he was encouraged by one of his aristocratic friends to join him on a journey around the world. So again, we've got these rich kids, and I think the aristocrat, he was 26 years old at the time. He became a captain of a ship, and he wanted a companion. And so Charles Darwin sponsored and financed himself to follow him around the world. And when you look at the journey, it's quite spectacular. They literally went around the world. And he, Charles Darwin, obviously did a lot of observations. He was sort of all into botany and into studying species and animals and birds and things like that. And we got the story of the finches and the different beaks. And that is the foundation of the theory of evolution. So then the book comes out. So this Beagle Journey, I've got a figure here, which is 1837 to 1839. So 2 years he was en route. He studied in Cambridge, I think, from 1831 to 1836, theology, and then his aristocratic friend took him on there a year later, if I get the figures right. Origin of Species only came out in 1859, and when you sort of see what was going on there, Charles was apparently a shy character. He didn't seek publicity, but he had all these ideas, and he was just formulating them for himself, and he looked at, you know, that one species comes from another and that there's all this developmental thing and all this is going on. But then some other guy by the name of, I need to pick it up now, of Russell Wallace was about to get out a book, you know, about the same ideas. And so Charlie had to be really, really fast, and he got his book out, and he got The Origin of Species out, and that was pretty much the great success. Obviously, he was a big money spinner as well. A little bit about his private life. He had 10 kids. His wife had the last kid when she was 48 years old. The kid was disabled, and interestingly as well, some of his theories about the survival of the fittest and all that changed around this time when his disabled kid was born. And anyway, that's just some stuff on the site. He put another book out. I mean, he made his name, and this was in 1871, The Descent of Man and Selection in relation to sex. And then we got a guy who was a sidekick, or became a sidekick of Charles Darwin. And this name is Thomas Henry Huxley, the father of Aldous Huxley. And again, in contrast to Charlie, he loved public speaking. And he moved on the debate that man comes from ape. So that was a big thing. And obviously that was totally outrageous at the time. We are talking the Victorian age. And again, let's go a little bit into the time context. So we had the 1700s, and John Wesley was one of the great preachers in the 1700s. A lot of people became Methodists. A lot of people were very God-fearing. And again, 1800s, we had about two revivals in the 1800s. There was one right at the beginning and one in the middle. So just about The Origin of Species was preceded by a revival. One of the results of the revival was a great missionary movement. So people were ready to go to the ends of the world to preach the gospel. And so there was a lot of stuff really going on within society and within theology as well, and people really wanting to walk on with God. And then Charles Darwin comes along, and Thomas Henry Huxley And he says, look, it's all a lot of tosh, you know. Genesis is not really true because we know, because, you know, Charles Darwin has written so much stuff and he's done so many studies, that man is descended from an ape. And that was totally outrageous. And obviously, what you find is you've got a strong Christian movement. You tend to find a strong opposition as well. And the opposition lapped this up. And that was the 1800s. That was the Victorian age. So a lot of people at universities and intellectuals who couldn't stand Christianity and who couldn't stand this revival mood which was going on and people going to the ends of the earth and preaching the gospel and stuff like that, they just laughed this, yeah, because it could just upset all those Christians. And they said, oh, this is the truth and what you are telling is rubbish. And there was this spirit of just destroying, very destructive spirit, rebellious spirit of just going against Christianity in these days. So that was the 1800s. What else have we got in the 1800s? We've got a lot of, it's interesting as well what was going on there. The Mormons started off, the Jehovah's Witnesses started off. A lot of cults, other than the Mormons, Jehovah's Witnesses, little cults which came up and died down, lots of them sort of sprung up as well in this time. So it was a really vibrant age. Then the next thing which started was the Industrial Revolution. Yeah, so suddenly science was elevated to a great level because of the advances in engineering, in metallurgy, and in building machines which were beginning to do the work men used to do, mechanization and things like that. So there was a great trust in science and in science being the answer for everything and changing human life for good. We started sort of getting motorized, and this is all sort of the late 1800s. The first car was sort of coming out about 1890s. So there were all these movements going on. There were advances in electricity. People started using Morse. Communication became quite vibrant. Again, all the 1800s. Late 1800s, early 1900s, people started sort of experimenting with wireless telegraphy and things like that. So you have to imagine this explosion of knowledge which was taking place in this time, this huge advance. We've got a spiritual advance as well. Beginning of the 1800s and 1700s, people were saying in America that Christianity was dead by the end of the century. And then suddenly it completely turned around and we started having these revivals in America and in Europe as well. And Christianity was just reviving from almost a death verdict to becoming the dominant religion. And then you got the opposition. And the opposition was looking for anything they could grab to try and destroy Christianity. And this was one of the things, the theory of evolution. And Huxley coming along and saying, look, you know, ape is man's ancestor. And it was outrageous, absolutely outrageous. Okay. Unfortunately, this is one of the things. When you look, even today, you know, if you want to become famous, you need to do something outrageous. You need to, you know, do something which sort of blasts the status quo to smithereens, and then you can guarantee that you'll be famous. And it's sad, but it's true. And that is what was happening in those days. So, yeah, Charles Darwin and you Thomas Henry Huxley, and they came up with these theories by just observing finches and having different beaks and having a little bit, you know, of adaptation within the species, and they were just making the jump and they're coming up with these fantastic theories that you know, species don't really were created as such, but they all have got a common ancestor, and it's all a development thing, and it comes from the survival of the fittest. Yeah. Okay, right, so that's a little bit setting the timeline, what was going on. We've got a guy called Herbert Spencer, who was a philosopher, and he was a big proponent of Charles Darwin, and he phrased the term survival of the fittest. Again, he's not a scientist, he's a philosopher. He comes up with the survival of the fittest. Now, philosopher is maybe a different term for theologian, but he doesn't deal with God, he just deals with empty philosophy. Right. Thomas Huxley, he was born in 1825 and he died in 1895. He was a bit younger than Charles Darwin, but he was sort of his mouthpiece. Sometimes he was referred to as the bulldog of Charles Darwin, so he was just pushing the whole thing through. He was an avowed agnostic. I'm just trying to look what else do we know about him. He did a big talk in 1966, and it was that blind faith is the ultimate sin. I mean, that's just totally rebellious. And he went on a speaking tour. It goes even further. A Quaker bequeathed him. So he died, and he gave him £1,000, $1,000 from his, which is a lot of money in those days. So it's not like today, probably the equivalent of $100,000 today. And he gave him a lot of money and for a speaking tour. And in 1869, he did his speaking tour, where he went around and he talked about this stuff. No, actually, that was in 1866. I'm just looking at my notes here. So the talk on blind faith being the ultimate sin. And that is obviously, it just goes against everything Christ said. Christ said, blessed is he who believes but does not see. When he was dealing with Thomas after his resurrection. Blind faith is good as far as the Bible is concerned. According to Huxley, it is the ultimate sin. This is again how crazy this whole thing goes. Okay, so we're looking at the 1800s, we're looking at the Victorian age, okay, and we have to imagine, what could these people know? So first of all they had was just books, yeah, that's all. Books were quite expensive, it was a privilege of the upper classes, people who had money, not the working class, so education was very, very often denied to them. Interestingly as well, the only people who, in those days, who gave them any education, who taught them how to read and write, the lower classes, it was the churches. The churches, they were doing it, and very often the nonconformist churches, like the Methodists, the Baptists, and so on, they had their Sunday schools, and they taught the poor people how to read and write for free. What else? We didn't have... interesting as well, Carl Zeiss, he developed lenses, and he developed... the science of actually calculating, real science, not science like evolution, to calculate the magnification factor of a lens by looking at the curvature. So he produced a formula and he produced some mathematics around it and he started producing them as well. So the first sort of microscopes which could amplify up to about 300 times, they came out in the mid-1800s. So that was well before Charles Darwin had his, well after Charles Darwin did his, journey on the Beagle. If he had a microscope, the ones he had available to himself were very limited. Yeah, they were not quite as good as the stuff that came out later. So they only started in about 1850s with all this technology. So, interesting when you look at this. So, the other thing as well is when you look at all these, things people were doing, photography was only developed to, some usable standard in about the 1850s as well. So, we had this big explosion of technology coming from the 1850s, but it wasn't really available to these guys. So, all these guys could do is they could produce drawings. And obviously, if they wanted to emphasize something, you can manipulate it with a drawing much better than with photography. Photography, in those times, you still had to have exposure times of sometimes minutes. It wasn't certainly not a second or something where you just squeeze a button and you can process or develop a picture from that. So that wasn't available. Okay, let's look at another guy. We're running out of time. Is Ernst Haeckel, 1834 to 1919. He pushed evolution and he pushed it to be taught in schools. He had ideas of racial hygiene and eugenics, and that's all based on Darwinism. He met with Darwin and Huxley and Lyell in 1866 to 1867. So they were all somewhere in the Canary Islands where they all joined together and had a good time. He went on a talking tour in 1876 throughout Germany, pushing this evolutionist agenda. And in 1905, he became a member of the Association of Racial Hygiene. Again, it's very offensive today, I think, when you look at this. So he was an avowed racist. There's no idea for that. And that was all based on the theory of evolution. And the origin of man and having different trees of where man, you know, has gone to. So he wrote a book in 1868, Die natürliche Schöpfungsgeschichte, Natural Account of Creation. And he looked at the, and he came to the idea that the origin of man was somewhere from Africa or South Asia, and he looked at sort of all the racial aspects of it. He was big in embryology, and Haeckel was convicted of fraud by his university in Jena. And you can see this in New Scientist, and this is from 1997, September, and it's on page 23. It talks about that he was actually convicted of fraud, and he said that the embryos, which he drew to prove the concept of evolution, and he says that basically the embryo goes through the stages of evolution, you know, from fish to man, and he tried to prove this by comparing human embryos with embryos from pigs and other ones, and whatever he drew wasn't correct, and he was convicted of fraud by his university, because whatever he drew, he tried to underline his, or the drawings he made, he tried to underline his ideas of evolution. The problem was that that it wasn't factual. The university convicted him of fraud, and today we still see his drawings in our biology books to explain the theory of evolution. We had Charlie Lyell, 1875, and he was a geologist, and he came up with the idea of stratification of the Earth and the old age of the Earth. He produced a lot of drawings, and it fit in with Charlie's idea of evolution. Lyell seemingly was a Christian or a religious man, and he had big problems in you know, splurting this stuff out, and he wasn't sure whether he was doing this, and he was really struggling with that. Russell Wallace had the same ideas as Charles Darwin, and this pushed Charlie to publish his books in 1859, I think it was, if I got it right, 1859, yeah. And then we've got Jean-Baptiste Lamarck from 1744 he lived. He was born and then died in 1829, and he had the concept of progressive evolution. He was one of the first guys to come up with this. And then he said that over time organisms become more complex, never been proven, it was just an idea, and he didn't have the means to prove it. He was a deist, meaning that God doesn't get involved in his creation, and he came from this premise. Okay, what are we learning from this session? What we are learning from this session is that these guys didn't really have a clue what they were talking about. They didn't have the evidence, they didn't have the means, genetics hasn't been designed yet. Mendel was contemporary with Charles Darwin, and he was just coming up with genetics slowly, and his ideas weren't even known until the death, after Charlie's death. Mendel's ideas were sort of rediscovered in the 1900s, and a lot of the stuff Charles Darwin came up with, it wouldn't make any sense whatsoever. Charlie had no idea about chromosomes, about genes. He had no ideas about what a cell looked like, the complexity of a cell, because microscopes weren't even ready. Good microscopes weren't available at his time, so with good, reliable magnification. So he wouldn't even see what's going on in a droplet of water or how a cell is constructed and how it's put together. No idea. No idea, the guy. All just made up. It's a fancy fantasy he's put together, and he's written a quarter of a million words about it. Okay, that's it. We have to come to an end. You're listening to the Christian War Room. Thank you for listening.
For the past half hour, you've been listening to the Christian War Room with host Michael Sean Bourne. For more information on how you can participate or find out more about the Christian War Room, simply go to ChristianWarRoom.com. That's ChristianWarRoom.com.